Paul, welcome to With the Wind, Science Revealed. Today I interview Dr. Alan Palmer. He's the author of 1,200 Studies, Truth Will Prevail. It's a massive book with links to all the references. We cover vaccine history, misconceptions, issues with ingredients, and reasons for declining mortality, herd immunity, and a whole lot more. Didi wraps this up by just talking to him about what it's like to be a doctor and a dad in this vaccine era. Enjoy the show. Dr. Paul, coming to you from the heart. My thought and topic today is intuition. That's your gut feeling. When you're faced with a difficult challenge or question, who do you listen to? I've really struggled with this recently because my youngest son just had a baby. So my grandson. New parents all have to face this question when it comes to vaccines. Obviously, I'm Dr. Mr. Vaccine, whatever you will. And that can make it difficult as well, how to communicate without seeming like you're telling somebody what to do. For them, they've got different voices coming at them. They've got grandparents on both sides, doctors, news, public health, and then there's me. What do you do? Intuition. You know that mama intuition? Moms just know, and I think dads, we have it too. If we can quiet the noise and listen deep within your gut, your intuition, God, if you will speak to you about what's right for you and your child. It's that silent voice. It's a knowingness. That's what I want to remind you, because I had lost my connection to intuition. And in the end, once you start reconnecting to it, you can trust yourself. You can trust your intuition. You can trust your child. Be quiet and listen to what they're telling you. Hold them, feel them, touch them, nurture them, and listen. Welcome, Dr. Alan Palmer, author of 1,200 Studies, Truth Will Prevail. That book, Alan, woke me up to, who is this man? You know, in the world of pediatrics, in the world of the vaccine story, we keep hearing the narrative, even today, they're safe and effective. Show me the evidence. Well, here you come with this massive work. But before we get to that, let me just introduce you to folks who may not know you. You worked with four professional teams over 23 years. You've had a successful private practice for over 30 years. You've created and directed three national sports chiropractic organizations. And then you shifted your focus to what is going on with environmental toxicity in children that seemed to be contributing to the meteoric rise in childhood neurodevelopmental issues over the last three decades. So that's when you changed your focus and came out with this incredible work. We'll get into that more. This ebook now has 1,500 studies. I mean, it's published by thousands of scientists, researchers, and journals, over 45 different medical and scientific disciplines. You've got links to reference studies. It's an interactive PDF, lots of easy tools. I've tried to work through it. I haven't read it word to word. It's such a massive document, but what a gift you've given to the world. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much, Dr. Paul. I mean, it really has been a labor of love. And I think what really started me on this journey, first of all, just to back up a little bit, in my private practice, like yourself, I'm sure, I always gave parents the option as to what they wanted to do. Now, a lot of parents would come to me, and as a chiropractor, obviously, I didn't administer vaccines, but they would come to me and ask me what I thought about this vaccine or that vaccine or vaccines in general for their children. And I would always tell them I had a lending library with a lot of research, a lot of books, different things. And I would always tell them, take some of this material home and start studying it and investigate it for yourself. Look at the research, look at the studies I have here, and then go to your pediatrician, your child's pediatrician, and ask for the same. Ask for the pediatrician to give you evidence of why they believe the vaccines are necessary, what the benefits are, what the risks are, et cetera. And then, you know, use your critical thinking skills and make a decision as to what you think is in the best interest of your child. And I think that's what's really gotten lost today on the interaction between pediatricians and parents is the fact that, you know, it's my way or the highway, or there's only one solution, only one way to look at things. And parents aren't really given that option in many cases. So that's the way I would approach it. And several years ago, I have four children that had never been vaccinated, extremely healthy children. And I just weighed the risks and the benefits, and I felt that was in my children's best interest. And so several years ago, I started seeing a lot of posts on social media, really chastising and denigrating parents who chose not to vaccinate their children. So I started with responding to some of these posts, and some of them were with relatives of mine. And then I saw an episode of Jimmy Kimmel one night where Jimmy Kimmel did a monologue where he just ripped into parents that chose not to vaccinate their children.
I remember
and
that.
They were doctors or they were actors posing as doctors behind stage. They had a lighting and backdrop set up, and they let these doctors say a few words. And those words were very condescending, very attacking parents who made other decisions than what they recommended. So much as to say, well, I've been to medical school for 8 years, and if you think you know more than I do about this issue, you know, you're wrong. And literally having to bleep out certain words, you know, in their statements. And at that point, I just said, it's game on, you know, it's game on. If it's gotten to this level, I need to try to provide an alternative source for people. And so I started my journey. It started as an article, it was the proverbial, like drinking water out of a fire hose. As I dug into PubMed and I started following rabbit trails. And this, mind you, this was back when Google hadn't changed the algorithms to where you could actually put in a search for something about vaccine injuries and vaccine adverse effects, and they would come up on the first page. They would connect you with different vaccine organizations where they talked about risks of vaccines. And so it made my job a lot easier, to be honest with you. If I had to create that work today, it would be very difficult, if not impossible, to do other than just getting into PubMed, which I spent a lot of time. I estimated I probably spent about 2,500 hours over 2.5 years creating the original version of this. And I update this ebook about every several months too, so that we have fresh information, anything new that's come out. And I just kept going, and eventually ended up being 1,200 studies in the original book. But mind you too, there's each study, as you know, Dr. Paul, has sometimes, you know, several dozen to 200 or 300 references in it. So each one of those studies, those 1,200 studies, has many other studies that support their position also. So there is literally probably tens of thousands of studies out there that basically contradict or refute some of the claims about the safety and efficacy of vaccines. So, and I created it as an ebook in a way that it's searchable. You can do keyword or key phrase searches. The whole table of contents are links to that story in the documents. So if you're going through the table and there's different sections and you see something that's on page 465, just click on that link and it takes you right there. So there's no tedious scrolling or anything like that. And you mentioned, you know, you haven't been able to read the whole thing. I'm very disappointed, Dr. Paul, that you haven't done that, but I'm kidding. I don't know if anyone has ever read the whole thing. I mean, it's right now it's close to 800 pages. However, I really designed it as a reference tool, as a research tool, so that people, whether it's parents or people looking at adult vaccines, they can just go through the table of contents and really pick out what they want to study or learn about. And it'll take them right to that article where I have excerpts from the different summaries and different key points in the study, and then the link to the study, because I don't want anyone to believe what I'm saying or believe what I'm putting in my ebook. I want them to have the ability to access the original material in the study to see for themselves if what I'm saying is true.
Yeah, no, you're so right. The point you made, it just was like, I'm a little concerned, a lot concerned for our world. The point you made about searches on Google. So most people get their data from Google. I mean, that's now become the preferred search engine. And I was with my sister a couple years ago and we were having the vaccine discussion, and she's a teacher in middle school. She teaches science, but she teaches the mainstream narrative. And I said, you know, Mary, I've written articles, vaxxed, unvaxxed study, real world data, and it's censored. She said, oh, nonsense. Let's look. So she said, oh, sure, I haven't looked, but let's look. She goes to Google, can't find it. But right at the top are articles smearing my article, you know, and it's like, it would be hard, wouldn't it, to get a hold of all this research. It's very hidden and buried and censored.
Well, and this is one of my concerns about artificial intelligence and the use of AI.
Yeah.
Who determines what AI tells people is true? And the powers that be. And it, we've seen so much misinformation and disinformation coming from our government and the media and everything over the last 3 years with COVID. I can only imagine if they collude with the people that are creating these algorithms for artificial intelligence, and it's going to make it even harder for people to get dissenting information or the opposite side. I mean, think about if you're sitting on a jury and all you have the ability to hear is the prosecuting attorney's case. You never get a chance to hear the defendant's case. You know, you can bet that those verdicts are going to go against the defendant 100% of the time.
Right.
So I think that that's really all I'm asking for, and all you're asking for is that there's a good civil discourse. People are allowed to be skeptical. I'm a healthy skeptic, I like to say, you know, a healthy skeptic, and the ability to think critically and base their decisions based on both sides of the equation, both stories.
Absolutely. Why don't we start with this question? I'm asked all the time, but what about all those diseases that, you know, vaccines have eradicated the diseases from the earth? You know, we don't want to go back to the dark ages. And what do you say to those folks?
Well, you know, that's interesting, because there are a lot of there's a lot of evidence out there, and much of this comes from the vital statistics of the United States, the records that they've kept over the years on the decline of infectious diseases. So if I could just share a graphic with you here. This is the United States mortality rates of some of the different infectious diseases from 1900 to 1963. So you can see over the course of the 20th century, the first half or so of the 20th century, you can see how those diseases were all declining significantly. In fact, it's estimated that measles had been declining about 99%. The measles mortality had declined about 99%. And you can see it on the far right there before the introduction of the measles vaccine. Now, the measles vaccine, of course, is credited for the elimination of measles and measles mortality. But what has really caused the reduction of these infectious diseases is improvement in sanitation, improvement in water quality, public health initiatives, different things like that, better nutrition, all the different things that help improve people's immune systems. In my ebook, I've got some interesting pictures from a great article where it talks about what living in the cities in the United States and in Western Europe were like in the early 1900s, late 1800s, early 1900s. And literally, if you can imagine, dirt streets everywhere.
Yep.
Cattle, cattle and horses and pigs walking up and down the streets, you know, being run, you know, directed right through town, and horses and, you know, with, you know, cow dung, horse dung everywhere. You know, a lot of people lived in squalor, and a lot of those tenement houses, you're right, they had open sewage behind the tenement houses. It was literally like a living petri dish that people lived in. And so, you know, the nutrition wasn't anywhere where it is today. They didn't even start fortifying foods until, I believe, the late 1950s, early 1960s with vitamins and minerals. And clean water was very hard to come by back then. So, you know, it's...
Is it any wonder?
Is it any wonder that infectious diseases were out of control? Now, if you correlate
the image, do you have the image of the measles decline?
I do. Yeah. Let me share that one with you.
Measles is the one that you know, those who are fearful of diseases and think that vaccines are the wonder that has saved us always point to measles and the mortality. But yes, this graph kind of says it all, doesn't it?
It really does. You know, it really does. And so I think, you know, the pharmaceutical industry has co-opted, I like to say, co-opted the narrative on the fact that these vaccines have diminished the infectious diseases. In fact, even with polio, because that's one that's brought up a lot, there was a 50% drop in polio over the first half of the 20th century, a 50% drop by 1955 when the polio vaccine first became distributed. And there was a 98% drop in polio by 1961, even before the oral polio was available. And so, you know, it's easy to, if you can compare what things were like here in the late 1800s and early 1900s to somewhere in the world today, I mean, it could almost be compared to the conditions in South Saharan Africa. Now, obviously, we had better building structures and a lot of different things like that, but the type of malnutrition or reduced nutritional qualities are very similar. You know, in some parts of the world where measles. So
I came from Southern Africa, and other than the slums, today Southern Africa has, well, cities. Some of them are vibrant, and some of them not so vibrant. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the slums would be similar to those tenement housing at the turn of the century.
And, you know, the thing about, let's talk about measles for a minute too. You know, one of the things that the measles vaccination program has caused really is it's ruined natural herd immunity. When children were getting measles, they would have immunity for life from the measles. And one of the reasons they had immunity for life is because as children grew up and became young adults and older adults, they were still around children that had measles periodically. So they would get natural boosters by being around those children who had measles. So that helped keep their titers up and keep their immunity up against the disease. Now what's happened is, and there was a great study I have in my ebook from the journal Vaccine in 2018, where they determined that the antibody titers for measles declines at the rate of about 9.7% per year. And for the mumps, about 9.2% per year. So if we look at, you know, just you can do the math. If the child is, you know, 6 years old when they get their last MMR shot, is that about the right age, Doc?
Yep.
Somewhere like that. So for, you know, in about a decade or so after that, you know, by the time they're in their late teens, they really have virtually little, if any, immunity for measles anyway. So when we do see measles outbreaks now, they tend to be in adults when the disease is much more serious. The other thing that they really play with is there's a lot of fuzzy math that goes on when you, I have a lot of examples of this in the ebook, but when you see, you know, the doctor on Good Morning America talking about measles used to cause, there used to be 1 in 1,000 deaths, you know, measles. It's really not true. I mean, the number of deaths, and they're talking cases, and this is an important distinction, and I know you understand this. Cases are ones that actually were severe enough to go to the doctor or the hospital. And the actual numbers, when you look at the numbers of measles mortality, was more like 1 in 10,000 cases. And there have been some really great studies to look at what children were the measles most deadly in. And what they found was in underserved counties and communities where, again, there was a lot of poverty, very poor nutrition, and those communities had 10 times the mortality rate than more affluent communities. So once again, we go back to the old debate, the age-long debate between Pasteur and Beauchamp is it the terrain or is it the germ? You know, obviously the germ has something to do with it, but more so it's the terrain, you know, the health of the person, the health of their immune system and so forth. So, you know, I just wanted to make that point because, you know, not only were the measles mortality naturally declining, but as we brought nutrition up, better nutrition and those types of things have improved, it further would reduce the danger from measles in young children.
Yeah. No, it's a good point. Measles, mumps, rubella, and chickenpox, the varicella vaccine. Those are the live virus vaccines that they certainly work. I mean, they create an antibody response that's protective. But as you pointed out, it wanes over time, and then you're vulnerable at a worse time in your life. And we've eliminated that natural boosting that used to happen. So there's a trade-off that doesn't really necessarily work out in our favor in the long run. What would you say, you've done such a deep dive into vaccines, which ingredients in vaccines are you most worried about?
Well, there's a lot of them. I go through them one by one in the ebook, but just to pick out some of the most egregious or dangerous ones, in my opinion, are the heavy metals, mercury and aluminum. As you know, the mercury was phased out of most of the childhood vaccines unless they were to get a flu shot today that was a multi-dose vial of a flu shot. But those are extreme neurotoxins. They're very damaging to the brain. And so there's, like, just as an example, I believe it's 26 of the vaccines now have aluminum in them, 26 of the vaccines. And by 18 months of age, the amount of aluminum that children get in their vaccines is about 5,820 micrograms by 18 months of age, which is extreme compared to, the FDA only allows in parental nutrition, which is IV nutrition that they might give infants in the hospital. They only allow 25 micrograms in per 24 hours to be in parental nutrition, which, by the way,
works out to 5 micrograms per kilo.
Yes, correct. Yep. And that's as a part of the a byproduct of part of the manufacturing process of these this IV nutrition. So they have strict regulations on that. But then on day one at birth, they want to give a baby a hepatitis B vaccine, or they do, I should say, in 99.9% of the cases, in which there's 250 micrograms of mercury, or I'm sorry, of aluminum. And so that's 10 times what the FDA allows in an IV bag for an infant that's in the hospital.
Right. And it's injected. It's injected, which means it's parenteral. And absolutely. It should be a crime.
Yeah. And as you know, Doc, I mean, a lot of times they compare the dosage within vaccines to the amount of aluminum that a child might get in their food and things like that.
Yeah. A formula is fairly high in aluminum, which isn't a good thing anyway. Most of the aluminum in food or in formula in the case of a baby is not absorbed. The intestinal tract is able to, keep out, I think it's 97% or something.
Yeah, I was going to say about 2% of that aluminum is even absorbed into the bloodstream.
Yeah.
So when they use these little tricks of comparing apples to oranges to try to defend their narrative. But yet when you understand the mechanisms and you understand the physiology and how this works, it's really a lot of smoke and mirrors.
Yeah. So we have direct toxicity from heavy metals like aluminum. We know that's neurotoxic. It's affecting developing brains. And the doses kids are getting, infants are getting, are just off the charts. It's unconscionable. What other mechanisms did you come across for injury from vaccines?
Well, and one of the things that I think is super important is to understand that, and I know that you studied this in medical school, just like I did in my chiropractic education. Most doctors that go to medical school study Guyton's physiology, which is sort of the gold standard textbook that is used. And, they learn about the blood-brain barrier. And so the blood supply to the brain has... there's certain gaps within that blood vessel that allow things to leach. They're called gap junctions. They allow things to get into the brain, and that blood-brain barrier there is supposed to also protect the brain from certain things getting in there. But that blood-brain barrier isn't fully matured until, some say, between 2 and 3 years of age. You can tell me what you think about that, Doc, as far as contemporary science, but that's what is taught. And so if you're getting almost 6,000 micrograms of aluminum by 18 months of age, you're certainly injecting all of those nanoparticles of that heavy metal into a baby who doesn't have that protective blood-brain barrier yet. And so a lot of those get into the brain. And then the mechanism is it causes an increase or an upregulation of inflammation due to the way that that affects the microglia of the brain, which is the brain's immune system. And so that causes a lot of inflammation in the brain. And that may be one of the reasons why some children have spike high fevers. They may have seizures after their injections and so forth. And obviously not every child appears to be damaged from vaccines. And this is another thing that's important distinction. Some children appear that they're not injured by vaccines. And in fact, many children don't. And so there are a subset of individuals that have certain types of genetic polymorphisms, they're called, or genetic mutations, where their body cannot detoxify from some of these chemicals and heavy metals and so forth like the rest. And so these are the children that are especially vulnerable. Now, why couldn't they develop a simple way of testing, doing some quick DNA testing on birth to see which children are susceptible and which aren't? And I would argue that they could. They could do a buccal swab of the inside of their cheek. They could check for some of these genetic defects and then choose not to inject some of these children. But to do that, they would have to first admit that there is a problem for some children, which they're not willing to do, because that would then expose them to the liability of admitting that children are damaged. Right now, there's no admission of that whatsoever, as you can tell when you follow.
Well, Alan, one other problem I would highlight in this discussion at this point is, you know, there's vaccine injury or damage, as you say, which we are aware of, but there's effects. So vaccine effects. And I would say that almost every child who gets the CDC schedule is affected by it, because
I agree.
Yeah. You know, it's in pediatrics and early childhood development. You know, I saw child after child who just, the lights were gone. You know, there's just, hello, nobody's home. I mean, just kids are just walking around in a daze. That's just one part of the effect. You know, it's damage at a lower level, perhaps, than say, you know, full-blown autism. But they're affected nonetheless. And then, of course, there's all the chronic diseases that we see that are much higher in the highly vaccinated compared to the unvaccinated.
I would love to bring this up at this point too. And most of your viewers are probably aware of the amazing study that you did with James Lyons Weiler within your practice. And you highlighted just that, you know, when you compared the group of children from your practice that had the full CDC schedule versus a partial schedule versus those that were unvaccinated. It was obvious, very clear and very obvious, that children who are more highly vaccinated have more, a higher incidence and more severity of different types of childhood illnesses. And so you bring up a really good point. One of the other shell games or things that they do in the clinical studies, and this is one of the things that I really was shocked about, but I believe with the hepatitis B vaccine in the clinical study, there were two versions of that vaccine. In one, they only followed the children for 5 days, and in the other for 4 days. And so, you know, they're not following children out to see what happens to them later. And then the other thing they do that really masks or hides the effects of vaccines is they tend to erase the placebo group, as it's called. What they'll do is once they're done with their study, if it's 30 days or 60 days, or they rarely go beyond that, they will actually vaccinate all of the placebo group. Now, when I say placebo group, we're going to get into some fun things here, because a lot of people don't know or don't understand what the placebo group really is in the childhood vaccines. The placebo group they've never used an inert substance like a saline placebo, which is what you should do so that you can see the obvious difference in effects or side effects or adverse effects from the people who got the vaccine versus the one that got the saline.
Yeah.
Well, what they will do is—
Let me highlight that to our viewers.
Yep.
Placebo should be something known to cause no effects whatsoever. Our bodies have a natural saline level, normal saline, you know, 0.9%. that's what's given when you're given an IV fluid and you need to get some, you know, balanced fluid into a person. You could give an injection of saline, normal saline, and the person would not know if that was a vaccine or not, because it's a needle, it's a needle. The vaccine would be in one needle, the saline would be in the other, but you would be giving, the control group would be getting basically water, and water that's at balance with your body. So we would know for a fact that there's no way that injection caused any harm. It cannot, other than the pain of the injection. They've, as you said, they've never done a control group properly. Carry on about what they actually use for control groups.
So what they will use is typically a different vaccine, or they will use an injection of aluminum, as much or sometimes more than is in the vaccine itself. And so, you know, really what they're doing is they're masking. And what does that tell you about what they understand about the risks of aluminum or the dangers of aluminum? If they're going to intentionally put aluminum in the saline placebo so that the same amount of, it's so that the same number of participants that get the placebo have similar adverse reactions to the vaccine, you know that that's one of the vaccine ingredients that they're afraid of is going to cause issues. So it's just a way of masking or hiding that. So those are just some of the things that I know. Robert Kennedy Jr. does an amazing, he does an amazing job in a video that they have on childrenshealthdefense.org about the Gardasil vaccine. And really he does a full prosecution, just like an attorney would, of their clinical trials. Because the other thing that they will do is, There are children that had autoimmune reactions from that vaccine in the trials, and they basically just said in the trial it just happened by chance. Basically, it wasn't from the vaccine; it just happened by chance. So there are other ways that they can mask those effects in children who do get the vaccine. And he does an amazing job of just really, if you want to see an expert really pick apart a clinical trial. Bobby does a great job of that.
Yeah, he does. The Defender, which is their daily online news magazine, covers Gardasil HPV vaccine very well. If anybody needs to get that data, and I imagine you have most, if not all, those studies in your 1,200 studies.
I do. a lot of them, for sure.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So what shocked you the most in doing your research?
Well, I think what really shocked me the most is, you know, I understood just from studying about vaccines 20 years ago or 25, 30 years ago, I knew that there was issues with safety and efficacy. But what shocked me the most is how deep the corruption goes. When you look at the revolving door, for example, between our health agencies like the FDA, CDC, HHS, and the pharmaceutical industry. And we see that the heads of these like the commissioner of the FDA or the director of the CDC will leave their job and then get a very lucrative job, like Scott Gottlieb did. You know, he left the FDA and he got this lucrative job on the board of Pfizer. And then during the COVID pandemic, when Pfizer rolled their shots out, he got on TV as the former FDA commissioner, which is somebody who should be very reputable. So he's going to have people's trust, who is on the board of Pfizer talking about the Pfizer vaccine. And, you know, that's just one example. But and then, you know, just understanding the depth of influence that the pharmaceutical industry has, especially the vaccine industry, throughout, you know, education, medical education, throughout the medical journals, throughout politics, throughout the media, obviously, about every show on TV now is brought to you by Pfizer, right?
Right.
And no, absolutely. And you know, they have all the more money now to be able to buy more influence and more power and more of, you know, the ability to control the narrative. So that's one of the things that really shocked me, is I didn't realize the depth of all of that. And yeah. Of course, you know, you're familiar with William Thompson, you know, the CDC researcher who came forward as a whistleblower and showed that, you know, the CDC study that he was working on as a senior scientist, you know, they destroyed the evidence to show that, you know, to show that the MMR vaccine did have some adverse effects, much more so in African-American males. And but again, here's where you become a little cynical, because what's ever happened with that? You know, he had all the documentation, all the evidence and everything, but that's never gone anywhere. And you know, that just kind of, again, is another indication of how deep, you know, this influence is of the pharmaceutical industry over even our political officials, unfortunately. Yeah.
So that, folks, was referring to, they were commissioned, asked to look at the potential risk of the MMR and linked to autism. And of course, in my pediatric practice, let me backtrack. As a kid growing up in Africa, I did not see a single case of autism, not right through high school. So it just never saw a case. And then it has skyrocketed. In fact, I think you have some autism data you can share, right?
I do. Yes, sir.
Yeah, let's put that up and continue this discussion. So in my practice, what I saw was starting around the early 2000s, it really skyrocketed. And let's have you cover what you've got on this graph here.
Well, so it's estimated decades ago that the incidence of autism was somewhere around 1 in 10,000. And this graph here is based on CDC data, where they have different monitoring sites. And they every 2 years, they publish a report that gives the relative incidence in autism. And if you look along the left side there, that vertical axis, the y-axis, it's the number of children with autism per 1,000. So those numbers along the left vertical are the number per 1,000. And what I've added in there with the red arrows and the red text is the number of children with autism. So in the year 2000, it was 1 in 150. You can see this latest projection, which just came out, again, it's 2 years or a little more than 2 years overdue. It was 1 in 36. And incidentally, California is 1 in 22. It's the highest rate in the United States right now. So what's interesting about California is they were the first state to mandate vaccines for children and eliminated the medical exemption. So now if there is a correlation, and I believe there is, between the number of vaccines that children get and the rates of autism, boy, that's a natural experiment right there that may be one of the primary reasons why it's so high in California. But what I ended up doing, because obviously we don't know now, right now in 2022, you can bet at the rate it's going, the trajectory it's going, that it is higher than 1 in 36. Those numbers just won't come out, you know, for 2023 until, you know, 2 years later. So what I did is I took over the last 15 years or so, I took the average rise per year and I projected it out to 2032. And in 2032, at that same level of increase, it would be one child in 18. I mean, think about that, one child in 18, and it's approximately four times more prevalent in boys than girls. So when you think about the number of boys that will have autism by 2032, even if it just stays at the same rate, now they've added the mRNA vaccines to the childhood schedule. That doesn't mean that, you know, all the states will mandate it. But if they're adding another 20 or so shots, maybe, well, each shot, like if each year they're required to get two doses to consider it a shot, I'm not sure if they will going forward. That could be 40 doses onto the 70 or 72 doses that children get now by the age of 18. That we might see that number going up exponentially. We don't know.
I'm very concerned about that with the mRNA technology. What we've seen from COVID is more deaths, more harm in a year of COVID jabs or 2 years of COVID jabs than we saw for 30 years for all other vaccines combined. So I know you're actually writing a book on COVID as well, I understand.
Well, you know, I guess I'm just a nerd, Dr. Paul. I guess I've become an investigative reporter, like a medical investigative reporter. When COVID hit, and I saw that things just didn't add up, because I saw the data that came out of Italy early. I saw who was really being impacted by the virus. It was people typically over the age of 80. People that had four or more comorbidities were the ones that were seriously impacted, at least for the most part. Obviously, some younger people are. But I saw the reaction. I saw the public health reaction and the different restrictions that were being put in place. I said, I need to take a deep dive into this and really start looking at it. So what I ended up doing was starting to do a monthly newsletter and where I look at the different research and the studies that are coming out from the different journals around the world, look at the data from the different governments around the world related to COVID, but also related to the vaccines when they came out. Last month was my 36th issue, and I never really believed I would still be doing this 3 years after the beginning of the pandemic, because to me, it was obvious that if we just took the path that the Great Barrington Declaration authors recommended, and that's to protect the vulnerable, protect the ones who are susceptible to the virus, and allow natural immunity to take its course, and don't shut down schools and things where children are at virtually statistically a zero risk of dying, healthy children at zero risk of dying from COVID and things like that. Even the masking obviously has been proven to be completely wrong. So I covered in my newsletter everything from masking to lockdowns to the epidemiology, the virology, the suppression of early treatment medications, natural alternatives for improving your immune system against viral insult. Every month I have a nutrient of the month. And so out of that, when the vaccines were rolled out in December of 2020, I started collecting or keeping what I had in my newsletter on the vaccines. Again, all the research, all the concerns, all the stories, all the different studies. And I started creating a document out of that. So it has grown to be about 1,500 pages now. But again, I designed it in a way, the same way I did the ebook, the 1,200 Studies, Truth Will Prevail, so that the table of contents, it's a month by month, I call it a chronology of the COVID-19 vaccines from their inception to their epic failure, because every month you can see the data that comes out when it came out, and you can see how the narrative that we were fed is well, you hate to call things a lie because that's pretty strong, but let's just say it was deceptive and untrue. And you know, my whole thing is, if the CDC has 15,000 employees, they should have put some people on reading all these studies, reading the research, reading the data coming out from Israel and from the UK and so forth, so that we could create some policy here based on countries that were actually being transparent with their data.
Right.
So at any rate, so that's my latest.
I'm going to have you back on. We're going to cover COVID in detail at another time. Before we wrap up this segment on vaccines and your amazing work, I want you to address herd immunity, because this people get bullied into vaccinating with this narrative that, you know, you're doing it for others, and if you don't vaccinate, you're selfish. And so vaccinating is the moral right path because of herd immunity that supposedly you're getting from vaccines. Can you speak to that a little bit?
You bet. You know, I talked a little bit about the destruction of natural herd immunity by vaccines. But if you think about it, you know, the goal in public schools, let's say, is to have 95% of the children vaccinated so that they can have herd immunity. It would be like as if those children lived in a bubble in that school and they were never able to go out into the environment and interact with other people. So if you have, let's say, 1,000 kids in a school and you have, you know, 950 of them that have been vaccinated and they have their quote unquote herd immunity, then they go home and they interact in the community with their families and things like that. I want to share another screen share here with you that will kind of show you the fallacy of that. So children don't live in a bubble. You know, they live in the world. And so herd immunity, if you look at herd immunity and various diseases, you would have to achieve a different level of immunity to be considered herd immunity. The more infectious diseases, you would have to have a higher level of coverage than the less infective diseases. And this is actually by the CDC. This is a CDC survey that they did looking at adults from the years 2010 to 2016. And it might be hard for your viewers to see, but if you look at the vertical here, this is the number of percentage of adults who have been vaccinated as adults for these different diseases. So if we're looking at vaccines creating herd immunity, and we look at the levels of adults who actually have had these vaccines, it's extremely low. Most of them are between less than 10% and 40% here. So nowhere near, anywhere near what would be required for herd immunity of the population. So the truth is we don't have vaccine herd immunity with any of these diseases. But yet most of these diseases we see as very rare. I mean, you don't see them very commonly, even though we do not have herd immunity. So it's just an example, I guess, if you will. And as we talked before, with the waning of the vaccines, the only way they could improve on that, I guess, is to require adults, or if adults would get vaccinated for the MMR, let's say, for example, much, much more frequently. But every time you get that vaccine, you're also running a risk of adverse effects from the vaccine and an accumulation of things that are in that vaccine in your body potentially. So there, again, we're back to the risk reward benefit. You never hear the CDC talk about anything preventatively. How many of you have heard a public service announcement by the CDC over the last 3 years about the benefits of vitamin D with COVID? I have right. probably on my website, I probably have about close to 100 studies. I believe it's about 6 studies on vitamin D with respiratory viruses, even from before COVID and with COVID, you know, and reducing the severity and reducing the deaths, hospitalizations and deaths. We haven't heard a peep from our Centers for Disease Prevention about anything like that, or getting sunshine, or opening up your house and getting fresh air, getting exercise, any of those other things, zinc, vitamin C, nothing. Yep. So that's disheartening when you see that our agencies have just a tunnel vision. They really have a one size fits all approach and a one approach for everybody.
Yep, absolutely. So I'll summarize that and just say innate immunity, natural immunity, far superior to that's created by vaccines for a number of reasons. And maybe we'll just leave it at that for now because we're running out of time. I'd like to, as we wrap it up, just go ahead and tell the viewers what you think, take home message, what you want people to know. I mean, you've been researching this extensively. Actually, before you do that, how can people access your work?
They can go to wellnessdoc.com, wellnessdoc.com, or they can go to 1200 studies. 1200studies.com will take them directly to my page on WellnessDoc with my 1200 studies ebook. But then go to wellnessdoc.com, and at the top, you'll see a bar at the top that says educational portal. And if they click on that, actually, if they just hover over that, you'll see a drop down. You'll be able to see my 1200 studies ebook, my newsletter, my chronology of the COVID-19 vaccines projects, all right there that they can access.
Wonderful. And then before I have Didi come delve into your heart, tell the viewers what you feel is most important that they know.
I think the most important thing that they should know is that a lot of people have lost the ability to think critically and think for themselves. And they will just, you know, there is the propaganda minister for Hitler, his name was Joseph Goebbels. And this is one of my favorite quotes to really describe what's happened. And not only just the last 3 years, but over the last few decades with regular vaccines is, and what Joseph Goebbels said, he said, if you tell a lie once, it's a lie. But if you tell a lie 1,000 times, it becomes the truth. And I think the most important takeaway I want people to know is no matter how many times you're told something by people on TV or the people in the news that are supposed to represent truth, you need to do your own investigation. You need to look at alternative sources of information. Ones that I'm not saying just crazy stuff. I'm saying evidence-based information. That has been completely suppressed the last 3 years. Evidence-based information and studies that come from peer-reviewed journals that would have always been accepted as science and allowed into the discourse. Think for yourselves, do your own research. Don't let anybody tell you what to think and really become a student of your own health so that you have control over your health and the health of the bodies of your children.
Beautifully said, Dr. Palmer. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Palmer.
We have to get back to critical thinking, and you cannot critically think if you don't have the right information. And so where you get your information is important. And wow, what a resource we have with 1,200 studies. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hi, Dr. Allen. Thank you for being willing to talk to me. So first of all, let's talk about, I know you're a dad. You and I had talked recently and discussed that you have a daughter. And so tell me how many children you have and what their ages are, if you don't mind sharing.
No, not at all. I have four children. My oldest is a boy. He's a man. He's 31. The next one is 28. It's a woman. She's our first to get married and have a grandchild. So we're loving that. And then the next one is 26 and 24. I don't know. I'm losing track here.
That's okay.
We had 4 and 6 years. So
there you go.
So wow. So it's 25, 27.
I've had 20, one in 24 years.
So and 31. That's I got it.
I love watching parents figure out how old their kids are when they have more than just
or two. How many years we've been married. I don't know.
That you better figure out quickly.
Yeah, right.
Okay. And then what you said, you have one grandchild now or one on the way?
One grandchild. Yeah.
Okay. How old's your grandchild?
7 months.
Okay. So going back, I heard you mention to Dr. Paul, are all of your children unvaccinated?
Correct. Other than my daughter, my youngest, the one who has some health issues right now that we were talking about, that had the issue with last week, night before last. She's a nurse. So when she was in nursing school, they really put the hard sell on her to get the MMR vaccine. We fought it. We tried to, get an exemption. But they said that she wouldn't be able to do her clinical rounds or internship at all because the facilities that they do those in require that. So she did end up having to get that. So we just used a bunch of different detoxification methods to try to offset any negative or any harm to her from it. So she's the only one that's ever had a vaccine.
Okay. And then how about your grandbaby?
No, my oldest daughter is on the same page as I am, 100%. So thank God for that. And she's a real learner, studier too, researcher. She digs into the information and they've chosen not to vaccinate. And interestingly, her husband has a brother who pretty much everyone believes that was vaccine injured. And so he's, I think, 33 now and, still can't live on his own and everything. And so he has a seizure disorder. So, so fortunately her husband was on the same page with her on this too. And they both agreed on the vaccine.
And, I think that's the difficult part right now, even with the COVID vaccine, we see spouses and just in families in general fighting what one person wants versus what the other person wants and what those beliefs are. And again, when media is telling you one thing and people like yourself, which thank God for you, are showing us the information and providing the science to see really what is the truth and allowing people to make the decision that's best for them. I think and I would like to know your thoughts on this, is we, with all the information that comes out there and those of us that are talking like you are and showing research, it's just blown off as misinformation and that we're trying to talk people into this horrible space of not doing what's right for everybody else versus just providing information. It's like, why can't everyone just see that it's information and make the choices that are best for you? I heard you saying that earlier. So what are your thoughts on when all this information is out there and yet people are hearing something else? How do you share with people how to navigate their way through all the information?
Yeah, and that is the million-dollar question, isn't it? That's really the biggest challenge. The zealotry and almost the religious nature that vaccines have become really the holy grail of medicine, right? Mm-hmm. And so, they are not going to budge on their position. For many reasons. I mean, obviously, there's the money. That's a big part of it. And the influence and how that, how that is all intertwined with everything we discussed, in our last hour. But there's also, the fact that if they were ever proven to be wrong on all these points, can you imagine the culpability for ignoring all this information all these years? So they're just double down, triple down, quadruple down. So for people, You really, again, have to go to alternative sources. And I think, you know, some really good ones are like Dr. Paul. You know, I mean, his interviews that he does are, he's going to bring on people who will give you alternative opinions, and not just opinions, but evidence-based information. The information that I can provide them, those other organizations, there's some other really good ones out there.
Well, and I'm going to interrupt you because that's a ton of information, and that's something we do have on this program. Okay. But what do you think about father's intuition?
Well, father's
trying to go with this. Don't you think being a dad and seeing what happens with your children, even your daughter now that's having these health issues that had to be vaccinated? And I know for me, my mother's intuition, even though I should have known better, and I still fell into certain things and watching what it did to my child. Can you talk to that? Isn't that real? Isn't that what's inside of us, whether you want to call it our gut, our intuition, absolutely, our faith in God, no matter what you want to call it? Don't you feel like that's real?
It is real. It is real. And first, to be clear, my daughter's current health conditions, I don't think is necessarily caused by the vaccine. She had a mold exposure, an environmental thing that she was living in and wasn't aware there was the mold in there. So I just wanted to be clear and honest about that for sure. But you're absolutely right. And, you know, father's intuition, mother's intuition. But let's face it. I mean, parents really want to do what's in the best interest of their children. And, and there is so much pressure put on them and so much coercion. They're made to feel like terrible parents if they don't follow the guidelines. And so, you know, I would never blame a parent for doing what they think is right, if they really think that that's right. But I think that, again, people need to be exposed to both sides of the information. And I have to tell you, I think mother's intuition is probably better than father's intuition. I have testified here in Arizona for some vaccine bills that we wanted to get passed. And I've spoken at a lot of different events. And I have to tell you, it's the moms that show up, and the moms that have these vaccine injured children too. And, you know, it really breaks my heart. And that's one of the reasons that really fuels me. It really drives me to keep going, is because I've heard these stories, and I've heard how mothers trusted the doctors. And then when they had this adverse reaction and these high fevers and seizures and everything, and would go back to the doctor, and the doctor would just say, well, that's just normal. Let's get this next round of shots. Some of them complied, and then their child, just like Dr. Paul said, all of a sudden just disappeared, you know, and wasn't there anymore right after the shot. So, you know, I think that intuition, and when you hear these women speak about their experiences, many of them said, this little voice kept telling me, it kept telling me, but I went against my intuition. Don't do that. Don't listen to your gut. Listen to God. Pray about it. Listen to the Holy Spirit. Whatever your beliefs are, you know, listen to that intuition, because that still small voice is extremely important, and most of the time won't steer you wrong.
What would you do, and how would you feel if, say, one of your children came and said, you know, Dad, I know how you feel and believe, and thanks for not vaccinating us, but now at this point, we really feel with some of these diseases coming back, we're going to vaccinate our grandchild. What happens for you if that happens?
Yeah, well, I think it would be very devastating for me. But I have to, all I can do is continue to provide, you know, try to provide in evidence-based information, try to encourage them. You know, I wouldn't give up, but obviously, you know, at that point in life, everyone has to make their own decisions. But I would definitely challenge it to the extent that, you know, we want to keep some semblance of peace in the family. I don't want to ostracize one of my children based on a decision like that, for sure. But I think it would be important for me to encourage them also to ask the pediatrician for data, for information, and then let me look at it and then see if I can counter it and provide them with information that might poke holes in some of the things that they say. Ultimately, each parent has to make their own decision. I would have to go back to the way I handled it in my practice. And I think that all you can do is try to inform. All you can do is do your best to educate. But ultimately, it's up to each individual. I would hate to see a grandchild, you know, go through that kind of a regimen with all of those shots so young. And knowing what it's doing to their body, whether it's being expressed in an obvious way yet or not, we know what it's doing to their body and to their immune systems and to their neurological systems. So it would be, I would have to use the word devastating to me.
So thank you again for joining us. And I'm sure we'll have more from you in the future.
All right. Sounds great. Thank you so much for having me on.
I look forward to running together with the wind at our backs, revealing the science that gives clarity in our world that's full of propaganda and misinformation. Visit our website, doctorsinscience.com. Sign up. Donate if you can. Your support makes a difference. And let's make this the weekly show the world has been waiting for. Thanks for watching. I'm Dr. Paul.